Hello and welcome to the Burgess Salmon Net Zero podcast. My name is Ross Fairley and I chair our Net Zero services here at Burgess Salmon. And today we're going to be discussing a few of the challenges and some of the opportunities arising from the UK Net Zero Challenge and Target. I'm delighted to be joined by experts in various areas of the firm, and particularly the quadrants which we believe make up Net Zero and which have to work together in order to achieve the government's target. So I have Sian Edmonds, our lead partner in agriculture, food production, land use, Ross Polkinghorne for the built environment, and Lucy Pegler on the transport side. I myself will contribute to the conversation covering energy, and we hope for a fruitful discussion today. Burgess Salmon is committed to net zero. We set our own target of achieving net zero by 2026. And we passionately believe that we have a big role to play in helping sectors and our clients achieve a net zero, partly because we do operate in the key sectors that are going to make up those areas that have to work together to achieve the result. So without further ado, I'd like to turn to our panel. So turning then to our experts, and I'd like to move to Lucy first, if I may. Lucy, what are the key areas and the key challenges that the transport sector in particular are focusing on at the moment when it comes to net zero?
Thanks, Ross. Well, I think this is quite timely because last week we saw that the Public Accounts Committee published a report on the government's plans to achieve net zero, and that highlighted the need to have a clear plan to achieve the 2050 target, being achieving net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. And importantly, that report flags the need for sector strategies and calls on BEIS to develop a public engagement strategy, noting that the transition to net zero will require behavioural change by the public. And I think that's one of the key issues that we're seeing in the transport sector. We need to see a shift to public and active travel and a real push to promote fewer car trips. And this is a really good example of the need for public engagement, because achieving this really does require significant behavioural changes in the way that people move around. The success of this is going to be really dependent on ensuring a joined up, cost-effective public transport network, which offers travel solutions based on the way people want to travel and the places they want to travel to. So we're really seeing more focus from local authorities who will be key in the shift in initiatives like mobility hubs and introducing new forms of mobility. For example, the e-scooter trials that have popped up in various city centre locations over recent months. Alongside this, the sector is also focusing on the decarbonisation of road vehicles. So we're already seeing investment from public transport operators in electric and hydrogen vehicles. But more generally, the sector is pushing for continued investment in new technologies and highlighting the need to secure sustainable supply chains. And I think the third thing for me is really in that continued push for investment in new technologies in freight. So with a focus on both heavy duty vehicles, but importantly, last mile deliveries, where the sector is exploring innovative technologies, for example, drone technologies, for moving some goods to relieve pressures on major roads and to reduce emissions.
Thanks, Lucy. That's great and really interesting. And we can come back to the collaboration and the crossovers between the other sectors for some of those things that you've just highlighted. Can I move on to Ross Polkinghorne? Ross, you're in our built environment sector. Our built environment, of course, is a massive area. It covers all our infrastructure, factories, housing. What things are really occupying that sector's mind at the moment as it gears up and faces up to achieving net zero?
Thanks, Ross. There are a multitude of issues in the context of the built environment, but I'm going to focus on four. The first one is actually the existing building stock, and in particular, the amount of carbon output from existing buildings is huge. And in order to tackle net zero, that in itself has to be tackled as well. And one of the key issues, particularly in the context of each of our own homes, is heating. So we've got about 30 million gas boilers in the UK at the moment. And effectively, they've all got to be removed and replaced with electric or some other form of heating in order to achieve net zero. And that's going to require some sort of government intervention, possibly via the tax system, in order to ensure that happens. Second one is value. At the moment, the cost of achieving carbon reduction is not reflected in the values that have achieved on sale in all sectors. And that's a real about changing mindsets from the top bottom to ensure that ESG in particular is embedded into the building life cycle and how buildings are built, let and sold and occupied. The third issue is data. How do you measure carbon, particularly in the construction of a building? How do you measure, ensure that a building is carbon friendly? In some sectors in particular, for example, offices, some investors are prepared to pay a premium and occupiers expect this for a whole hope of social or well-being issues. And it really is difficult to measure. And finally, just picking up on a point that Lucy mentioned earlier, which is power, particularly in the context of industrial, with new fleet procurements moving to electric vehicles, there's a real need to ensure that there's grid connectivity at a number of the industrial developments in order to ensure that the drones and freight of the future can be powered. And there are grid constraint issues with that.
Thanks very much, Ross. Really, really interesting. And again, we'll come back to the codependencies and on that. And I might pick some of that up in what I'm saying about energy in a moment. But first, I'd just like to turn to Sian, if I may. Sian, on the land use and the food production side, what's the sector saying?
Well, the big thing we're starting to hear more about is new forms of land use to achieve net zero. Of course, renewable energy has been an opportunity for landowners for some time, but there's no doubt that the use of land for greener energy production is a continued area for growth. On top of that, though, we now have some other issues which do involve a bit of a mindset change, but really do provide opportunities for landowners. So we're starting to see land being heralded as a means of carbon capture via initiatives such as tree planting and soil management. The new Environmental Land Management Scheme, or ELMS, which has been introduced to replace the old Common Agricultural Policy subsidy regime, is destined to provide around £2.4 million per year in subsidies for the provision of public goods. And that's going to include issues such as carbon capture initiatives and increasing diversity and biodiversity. We're still waiting to hear the real detail on that, and the regime isn't going to be fully implemented until 2028. But there's a lot of consultation going on around not only what sort of initiatives will be set up, but also how their success can be measured and recorded. Then on the food production side of things, we're waiting to hear what part two of the National Food Strategy says. That's due out later this year. It's looking at a blueprint for a joined up UK food system, which is designed to no longer make us or our planet sick. It's likely to focus on sustainable use of resources, investment in science and tech, and high-rise urban greenhouses and food production methods, all geared towards that sustainability net zero picture. The government's committed to producing a white paper following the recommendations from the food strategy report, but we have little information about exactly what that's containing and what the timeline is likely to be, other than a commitment to produce a white paper within 6 months of the report coming out. So we're waiting to hear what that might say in detail.
Thanks, Sian. Really interesting. I think the change in dietary requirements as well is just going to have huge implications across the piece, also for the infrastructure that supports those new dietary requirements as well. So we mustn't forget that. Well, just before we come on to some of the areas where there's crossover between the various sectors that we've just been talking about, I suppose I ought to pick up the energy baton and the decarbonised energy baton and run with that. I think the energy sector in particular has obviously faced up to decarbonisation over the last couple of decades, and with a huge degree of success on the electricity side, to be fair, with the development of renewable energy, wind and solar and other forms of generation. I think the key things that the generation sector and the electricity and energy sector need to face up to is the fact that there's going to need to be a lot more of it, frankly. And I think Ross was mentioning heat. Heat is a huge issue for energy and has not really been tackled thus far. And I think everyone's attention is moving to that. The challenge we all face with heat and energy faces with heat is that different forms of heat, different specs of heat are needed for different purposes. And it's not easy. Ross mentioned the interactions there and the retrofit of heat. But if you look at it on an industrial scale as well, it's not an easy thing to get to grips with. But to get to grips with it, we have to do. I think the other thing that's occupying people's mind in the energy sector is the fact that we are just going to need more of it. Everyone talks about electrification being the answer to everything, and that means a massive deployment of additional renewables. So we've already gone through a renewable energy boom in the UK, but we're going to have to go through another one. And some are predicting that, frankly, we're going to need every piece of energy and every technology that we can get our hands on. That leads you then on to talking about and thinking about what the opportunities for the UK economy are in terms of jobs and input and technology that we can sell to other countries. And that's indeed focusing the minds of government at the moment. It's no doubt that there is going to be no doubt that some of this electricity and generation and energy is going to be intermittent. And that leads us down a path of having greater flexibility to compensate for that when the wind is not blowing and the sun's not shining. And then I think the last point that has occupied everyone's mind for quite some time now, as we've moved towards decarbonised energy, is what do we need to do for the infrastructure, the grid infrastructure to get electricity, the infrastructure to get the replacement for natural gas into houses, all of that infrastructure, is it fit for purpose? What investments needed into it and how are we going to approach that? So those are the big macro issues affecting the energy sector. As I say, the electricity industry's had a good head start, possibly compared with other sectors that we've talked about today, but there's a lot of work to do. Okay, so I think it would be useful now just to go around the room, if we can call it that, and just ask you to highlight from your particular areas some of the interdependencies that you see between your area and sector and quadrant, if you like, and the others. So I'd like to go back to Lucy, if I may, on the transport side. What are the key interdependencies that you're seeing, Lucy?
Well, I think for me, there are two that really stand out, and they're actually really closely related. So the first one is something I mentioned earlier, which is around sustainable supply chains. And I think this is an issue not just for the transport sector, but for all sectors across net zero, where we are going to be relying on a small number of participants in the same supply chain. So I think energy is a really obvious example, where the transport sector is likely to put a huge demand on the energy sector, but so are all of the other sectors that we've spoken about. So it's how do you build that resilience in that supply chain to ensure that it can meet the demands that are going to be placed on it for meeting the 2050 target. The other thing for me is ensuring access to data to enable strategic decisions to be made that are informed by relevant, accurate, and importantly, up-to-date data from the other sectors. And that's really going to inform how we move forward with the planning for the transport sector, but also for other sectors that are impacted by this.
Thanks, Lucy. Ross, what would you say?
Again, I'll probably look at three, actually. So what are the key ones in the context of built environment is energy and energy resilience. Obviously, all buildings need power, or most buildings need heat. And the requirements in relation to energy and energy resilience are different in the context of asset classes. So Ross has already mentioned heat, as I mentioned before, particularly in the context of homes, is a huge challenge in terms of the sheer number of gas boilers already in existence. And power, as Lucy mentioned earlier, in order to procure, in order to power our electric fleet, there's going to need to be new power and energy supply into logistics and warehousing and distribution facilities. A link to that, I suppose, is transport. The built environment is integrated completely with our transport network. Whether that's in the context of logistics, whether it's freight, drones, or trains, you know, for example, railway stations, hydrogen trains, the impact that these new forms of technology and as transport becomes more of a service, effective, will have a huge impact on what the built environment looks like going forward. And finally, just picking up on land use, as Sian said, land use itself is key in unlocking net zero. I mean, put simply, the built environment is built on land. I mean, it's absolutely integral in terms of how they interact with each other. And in particular, one thing we mustn't forget is biodiversity and net gain when it comes to land use. And the move to biodiversity compensation in particular is a really interesting challenge. And for all those involved in owning, building, occupying, developing and repurposing the built environment going forward, all three of those core sort of sectors are absolutely fundamental to how the built environment achieves its goal of net zero.
Great, thank you. Sian, what's your views on this?
Well, food production in a sustainable but also a resilient way with the use of energy and other resources is a really big issue and continues to be one that that we're all going to be grappling with going forwards. We're certainly going to see, and indeed at Burgess Salmon, we're working on vertical farming initiatives and other forms of innovative, sustainable, urban-based food production systems. And of course, there's a big interplay there with the built environment. Use of energy and resources right through the food supply chain from primary production through to food manufacturing is crucial. And the transport systems involved in all of that really play into the net zero picture. Yeah, how do food producers go about making their transport systems net zero, also their manufacturing processes and their buildings? All of this is, there's a real interplay between these various areas. And of course, as we've mentioned before, and as has already been touched on, there are a lot of net zero initiatives which are going to require land at their very core. So the land sector is really eyeing up the opportunities that net zero can bring.
Thanks, Sian. I suppose from the energy side, I mean, it's quite interesting to listen to you all, because all of you have mentioned energy, and of course energy has a huge role to play in all of this, all of these areas, and there is the challenge for us in one shape or form. I would tend to agree with Ross in terms of the energy resilience, because I think that's going to be huge interdependency amongst all of the sectors, and particularly I think where energy is going to be generated and produced and where it's going to be sited. And how that's going to work with all of the sectors. I couldn't agree more with Sian, and I think Ross also mentioned it, that let's not forget, when we talk about energy, you have to build projects somewhere, and building projects somewhere requires land. And where is that land going to be, and where are they going to be situated? And I think the other key macro issue which cuts across all of these is, how are we going to get the energy to the users? Because there is a tendency sometimes to talk about energy generation in whatever form and talk about it as a sort of isolated, we need to generate this, but the reality is we need to get it to the users, and we also need a demand for the energy that's produced. So what's going to happen about that? How are we going to get it to the people? What are they going to use it for? I think is an interesting one going forward, and will involve interactions with all of these sectors, I think. Okay, look, I'd like to wrap up, if I may, by just going round the team here and just asking you for one thing that you think is going to lead to a success or would need to be tackled in order to reach success in net zero that seems to be weighing heavily on your mind at the moment. Maybe if I can go to Lucy.
Thanks, Ross. I think for me, and hearing what you've all said in terms of the interdependencies between the sectors and the need for decisions to be made and that decision making to develop over the next months and years. One of the key things for me then is really data and ensuring that we've got a really well-resourced kind of data sharing pool across the sectors. That's going to be absolutely key to creating efficiencies and ultimately achieving net zero. And that data needs to be available to government, to local authorities, businesses, but also importantly to people, so that individuals can understand how their decision making impacts on reducing carbon emissions. And for me, one of the key challenges here is really around data sharing. And that is something that I think really needs to be unlocked to ensure that flow of accurate and reliable data across sectors so that people can start using it to ensure that those informed decisions are being taken and that strategic planning is really able to progress.
Thanks, Lucy. How about you, Ross?
I mean, it's a similar thing to Lucy, actually. I mean, one of the key things for the built environment is basically the embedded carbon within a building. So that's both during the construction, whether it's the materials, the supply chain, and also during its occupation. And I know this is something that the UK Green Building Council are looking at in its route to net zero as a sector for the built environment. But you know, there is evidence out there at the moment that people will pay a premium, particularly in some sectors like offices, for carbon-friendly buildings. But effectively at the moment, it's really, really difficult to measure.
Data everywhere. Data is going to be needed. Sean?
For me, I think the issue is going to be around making sure that there's a collaborative and joined up approach across government departments as far as the food supply sector is concerned. At the moment, the sort of rural land use side of things sits under DEFRA's remit, whilst the further down the food supply chain, you have BEIS responsible for the various issues that that affect food manufacturing businesses. And I think ensuring that there's a joined up approach between those government departments so that we get across the supply chain a sustainable and collaborative approach to how we go about achieving net zero is going to be crucial.
Thanks, Sean. I couldn't agree more in terms of collaboration, and I'd probably go even wider than that. I think there needs to be collaboration across, as we've talked about, all of these sectors and government at the highest level to achieve this, because there's a real danger that if initiatives are focused in one particular area or sector, they may not actually fit with what everyone else is trying to achieve elsewhere. So we really need to watch that and be careful of that. I suppose my point that I'd like to make is really around mobilising local government and the regions. I think if we're going to deliver net zero successfully, we have to have the regions bought into it and mobilise them. They're the ones that will be delivering it on the ground in their particular areas. It does focus again on collaboration between regions, obviously, but I think we really do need to mobilise them, use them to best effect, and find a way of doing that successfully. I think I'd probably also like to say that we've talked a lot about the challenges here, and there's some big challenges here, but it's also a fantastic opportunity to decarbonise for our population, for our generations to come, but also if you look at what the government's doing and calling upon in terms of the green recovery, there is a fantastic opportunity if we can get this right to produce new industries, to develop new skills, to boost employment. And I think we should focus on that and be really positive about the results that net zero can achieve if done properly. Look, I'd like to thank you all for contributing today. And I'd like to thank you all out there for listening to the Burgess Salmon podcast. Thank you to Lucy, Sean and Ross for your great contributions to this podcast. This year is going to be very busy, I think, in terms of net zero and setting the agenda. And of course, we have COP 26 coming up, which is no doubt going to lead to a raft of announcements from UK government as well. We're going to be watching that very closely. And of course, net zero is only starting out, so this is going to take decades to fulfill. So this is an ongoing project, and we will be certainly holding more roundtables as we go along and updating the thinking around what's happening in the space. If you'd like to know a bit more about what we're doing on net zero, go to our website. We have a net zero blog, and we also have a web page around that, and you can also find our names and details there as well. And I'd finally like to thank you all again for listening to this Burgess Salmon Net Zero podcast. Thank you very much.